Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Craig, it is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And today I am here with a man who set the Blackpool Magic Convention on fire with a couple of releases that were absolutely banging. Very jealous of this man because he's got to work with the legend that is Michael Murray. We just reviewed one of his new products, which both myself and Rylan gave 100% for. He is the one and only, the absolutely amazing, and also the coolest beard in the whole of magic. I have to say that right now. Daniel Dorian Johnson. How are you doing, Daniel? You okay?
I'm very well. How are you, Craig?
I'm very excited to have you on the channel. I really am. And I appreciate that the lighting matches your beard. It's these little points that make a big difference to me. So thank you for that.
I did it deliberately, but I didn't realize while I was setting everything up that it kind of, you lose the definition of the beard. So I messed that up, but
Now you look good. You look good. And before we start this interview, and genuinely, one of the first, when I went to Blackpool, one of the highlights of the convention was meeting you and seeing your stuff. And when I came back from the States after Blackpool, the first phone call I made was to you because I really wanted to do an interview with you because I don't know that much about you. And I was so impressed at Blackpool with all of your material. And we'll get into that a little bit later on. I'm very impressed with you as a person as well. And we'll talk about why that I really wanted you on the channel. But before we start any interviews, you need to clear this up, man, because I've said to a couple of people, I'm interviewing Daniel Dorian Johnson. Oh, who's that? Oh, Bucket Friendly Cups and Balls. And they go, oh, Mr. Freak. I'm like, what do you mean, Mr. Freak? That sounds like a superhero, like, or something. Like, what is this? Like, I'm really confused.
So, Mr. Freak was the name of the character that I developed when I was about 16. When I first started street performing, because primarily over the last 10 years, I've been doing sideshow material, contortionism, human blockheads, body burning. I've made most of my living over the last 6 years as a sword swallower. So Mr. Freak is the name that I've been known as professionally for a while. But I made the change decision last year or the year before to start going by Freak, just kind of as my name.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So, like, I publish everything under Daniel Dorian Johnson because if somebody's Googling my act, I don't want them finding my releases.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, like, if you're Instagramming me, it's Mr. Freak _ street show. You're not going to find any of my other stuff from there.
Okay, so when I put this up online, I'm going to say an interview with Daniel Dorian Johnson.
Yeah.
But to make you feel comfortable throughout this interview, I'm going to call you Freak. How's that sound?
I appreciate that. And if, like, you slip up or anything, I'm not going to shout about it, you know.
That's cool. Right, so let's get into this because I have spoken to a couple of mutual friends and they've said that you're one of the most interesting people they know. So I want to know all about you and I want to know what makes you tick. Now, recently, you've set the world on fire. You were one of the things that everybody was talking about at Blackpool with Fast and Pocket Friendly Cups and Balls and, you know, being associated with two giants of the Northeast area, you know, both Magic Box and Michael Murray. I mean, that's incredible. But before we get into all of that, we need to figure out where you came from, what made you tick. Now, you dropped a nugget there. You said that it was 16 that you developed the name. And you've also talked about it's not just magic with you, it's sideshow, it's stuff like that. So I'm not going to say when did you get into magic. When did you get into performing? How did that happen? Because it sounds like you ran away with the circus as a kid from what you just told me. Like, where did this all come from?
Well, it does stem from magic. When I was six, a classic magician story, when I was six, a street performer from the Newcastle area came into my school right before Christmas, Mr. Twister, Darren Bonus, who is still working today, and a good friend. came and did a show, and I ran home and begged my parents for a magic kit, and the idiots got me one, so it's entirely their fault. And since then, like, obviously with anybody who picks up magic from a young age, you kind of let it fall off for a little while and then pick it back up later. But I hovered through it for a long time. And in that time, I was doing a lot of other performance work. I was learning to sing. I was learning to dance. I did. Do you know what the gang shows are?
No.
So it's a scouting thing. I've grown up in a scouting family, so always deeply entrenched in that. And they do kind of like review shows.
Okay.
A little bit like The Follies, but not as adult themed. So it's dances, sketches, musical numbers, stuff like that. So I was developing stagecraft, stage presence all the way through that, and then came back into magic and circus about the same time. Circus is a weird one. So I'm, aside from all of the myriad of other things wrong with me, I'm dyspraxic.
Okay.
Which affects your focus as well as your hand-eye coordination. I can't really coordinate anything between my hands and my eyes. And so I set myself the challenge of learning how to juggle. I have to do that entirely based on physics and my limited understanding of how objects fall.
Wow.
Yeah, so if you see me juggling anywhere, I'm thinking so hard about what's happening in that moment. I've managed to get it to the point where I can like talk and do gags and occasionally like look at different things, shift focus. But yeah, I've had to learn the hard way how to juggle, and then I learned to unicycle, and then I started developing my own magic material. And then I joined a local youth circus at around about the age of 14, I think. And my favorite things to watch were always the jugglers, the fire eaters, the sword swallowers, the bed of nail guys. So when I was in my 20s, I'm still in my 20s. When I was at the start of my 20s, I suffered a massive crisis because I'd gotten a job and depression. And so I decided to take the plunge and actually learn sword swallowing. And then that was my living for a good few years. And then the world burned down.
Okay, but I'm going to reverse onto some of this stuff because we're jumping ahead, and I don't want to jump ahead because this is really interesting. So the first thing I've got to ask is, why did you teach yourself juggling? Because, I mean, you've got dyspraxia, so you find it really hard to do anything like that. So you think, I know, that's what I'm going to do. Was it a case of you wanted to prove that you could do it? Was it a proving thing, or was it like... there's a million, you said that you love performing, there's a million things that you could do that didn't involve having to learn something that you would naturally find very bloody difficult. And yet you've done it and mastered it. And like, I've got so much respect for you from just that alone, but why put yourself through all of that pain when you didn't need to?
It stems kind of back to the gang shows. They were doing a circus number with a lot of stuff from Barnum, the musical, which if you've seen The Greatest Showman, everything you like about The Greatest Showman, you owe to Barnum. So they were doing a few numbers from that, and they wanted a juggler in there, and I am nothing if I'm not an attention whore. So over the course of the 6 weeks that they do rehearsals, after finding out they were doing this number and needed people who could juggle and everything like this, I brute force taught myself how to throw and catch things. Because before then, like any sports, like PE lessons, anything like that, I would just go and sit in the corner and think. Because if there was something heading towards me, it was hitting me in the face, the chest, the balls, or not at all. I couldn't catch anything. And it's still kind of the case of if somebody throws me something, there's about an 80% chance I'm going to miss it. But if I'm controlling the throw, I can generally do that. So yeah, it was kind of a moment of wanting to stand and have a lot of people look at me, and kind of a moment of wanting to prove to myself that I could do it.
Okay. And we kind of forwarded from the age of 14 to early 20s in that that when we were chatting earlier, you went...
Sorry, yeah.
So I'm just genuinely interested in your life. It's fascinating. So at the age of 14, you were really interested in circus. You taught yourself how to juggle and you got fascinated with sort of, you know, the sideshow type entertainment. Did you start performing at the age of 14? Or did you, like, because you said that you created the name Mr. Freak at the age of 16, but then you said that you're in a job at 20 and then you decided to do sword swallowing. I'm just trying to get the timeline because I'm finding this fascinating. So at the age of, the first question is, did you go straight into performing from school? And what made you decide to go with the name Mr. Freak at the age of 16?
I've been performing on stage since probably about the age of 8, doing, like I say, the gang shows and little bits of amateur dramatics. I've been performing by myself probably since about 14. Yeah, and then after I joined the local youth circus, they had a program called Streets of Durham. Durham, if anybody doesn't know, it's a city in the north of England, and it was a street festival. And they were hosting something called the New Street Performers Program. Mm-hmm. And I had seen a street performer back when I was 8 and really enjoyed the format and the feeling of watching that. So I dove straight at that opportunity and they helped me construct a very rough act. And realistically, they should have said no to a lot of things that I wanted to do. So that was when I was 16, and from there I just took myself out on the street.
Wow. So you did, so you, so at 16 you were going out on the street.
Yeah.
And what sort of, we've been talking a lot of sideshow entertainment and circus. We talked about magic at the beginning. That's what got you into it. Were you still doing magic at this point? Was this still a big thing for you? Or had it been superseded by all the other stuff?
I think sideshow and circus had kind of taken over. I was still obviously practicing magic. I was still learning card tricks and starting to develop my own taste for material, as well as like the building works of developing my own effects. But no, I would have said that street performing and sideshow had taken over by then, from probably about 16 up to 18, I think.
Okay. So for those 2 years from 16 to 18, it was all sideshow street performing. We'll get to what happened at 18 in a minute.
Yeah, very bad street performing. I should preface that. It was not good at all.
But you've been street performing your whole life, so it's obviously got better.
Yeah.
You know?
I'd hope.
Any before we go on to continuing with the timeline, any advice on street performing? Because I'll be honest, it's something that I've always wanted to do. I've never done. I'm now probably too old for it and too busy to do it. But I've got friends that do it. Like I'm very good friends with Cosmo in America. I don't know if you know Cos. And I know a lot of street performers. And it's something that a lot of magicians think about doing. Oh, I'm going to be a street performer. It's a really good idea. But it looks quite hard. You know, it doesn't look like it's the easiest thing to do.
It's not. Once you've been in it for a while, you start to develop a good sort of grift sense of what works and what doesn't. But my main advice would be don't be afraid of structure. Within the street performing community, there's a lot of older performers that remember fondly the days of like the 60s, 70s and 80s, where street shows were just loosely confined anarchy. And just absolute madness was happening. And then from after, I think, about Expo 88 over in Australia, Australian street performers started developing a very strictly regimented structure for street performing. And that's kind of been seen as the boo word. Like, structure seems to be a bad word amongst a lot of older street performers. So my honest advice is don't be afraid of structure. I'm happy to talk about the structure I've developed if you want.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to spend a couple of minutes talking about it, that's fine.
Yeah, I coach people through this all the time. I'm always happy to sit down and help anybody that wants to get into this world, because street performing saved my life in my early 20s. And if I can help anybody who's in that same position, I'm more than happy to help out. My structure is, I call it billboarding. Mm-hmm. So if you pick a finale trick, Cups and Balls is my finale trick for my magic show, which is 45 minutes. So my finale trick, my Cups and Balls, or as I call it, the world famous three ball trick. And that is all I talk about through the show. The entire show is just leading up to that one trick. And everything around that is just warming up the audience. So there are three main pieces to the way I structure a street show. It is crowd build, clap and cheer, and then big trick. Obviously, there's fundamental categories in between all of that, but yeah, crowd build, one trick that's big, flashy, and fast, that is just going to drag people in while you're talking about the world famous three ball trick or something like that. For me, I light a torch, a fire torch, set it on the ground, and do a little psychological pull thing with a piece of rope to bring everybody in. It's not even really a trick. It's just me saying words while there is fire. And then my clap and cheer moment, that is to get the audience making noise. So once I've got my edge and started the show, I want that audience to make as much noise as they can for something that's kind of impressive, but not what I've promised, because that generates a bigger audience. A crowd gets a crowd. So what I do for that is I balance my walking stick on my face with a hat on top of it. I take off my jacket without letting the stick or the hat fall. The minute I drop the jacket on the ground, everybody claps, you go absolutely wild. And then I bounce the hat off top of the stick just with my hand, drop the stick down by my side and catch the hat on my head.
Wow.
It's a pretty standard juggling trick. And it's made easier by the fact that there are special weighted juggling hats that I would never wear to leave the house in, but work well for attracting attention. And it's just a way to justify having them there for a couple of extra minutes and making my edge build a crowd for me.
Got it.
Then from there, go straight into the finale trick. If there's a way that you can incorporate a child in your show without it being creepy, that is important. I see a lot of people do this wrong without it being creepy. Then your show is going to build a crowd and keep a crowd for even longer, because as Cellini said back in the 80s, stop a child, stop the world.
Got you.
It's just an inherently interesting thing to watch, as well as have a point to your show. Have an underlying message or an idea that you want to communicate. Like, don't just be like, hey, watch these things I'm gonna juggle rubber chickens on fire while on a 6-foot unicycle, and aren't I cool. Have a point to your show. My point of the magic show is follow your dream.
Yeah,
that's good. Yeah, that's really it's good. Something I genuinely believe in. So
that's really good.
Use a structure and have a point.
Wow.
It's the best advice I can give.
That is genuinely a masterclass. That's great. I've listened to a lot of people talk about street magic. That's really insightful. And you can tell you've been doing it a long time. So we're going to come back to that. But
yeah.
So 16 to 18, that's what you were doing. You were working the street and you were learning how to do everything that you've just said, because obviously a lot of what you've just said comes from experience. You know, you can't be good without being bad. You need to find somewhere to be bad to be good, I imagine. So
absolutely.
Yeah. At 18, did you carry on working the streets? Because I know you said that you had a job at the age of 20, and then you, like, how did you get?
Yeah, no, at the age of 18 going on 19, I became a barman at a local bar by accident. I didn't mean to. It wasn't the plan. I went in there hoping to get a residency. I worked one evening going around doing magic and mentalism around the tables. Instead of letting me keep doing that for one evening every week or one evening every month, they hired me as a barman, and then that job crushed my soul, is the honest truth of it. I know some amazing bar staff and people that absolutely love working there, it's just, I couldn't hack it. Mm. I absolutely could not do that. And yeah, it broke me.
That's horrible to hear. I'm really sorry. But then you said that street performing saved your life at the age of 20. So is this all intertwined?
Yeah.
Is being crushed by the bar job and being saved by the streets part of the same story?
Yeah. So just before my 21st birthday, I think, I had a complete breakdown while at work. The bar was just absolutely... Have you read A Moral Man?
No, I haven't, no.
By Derek Delgadio?
No, I haven't, no.
Absolutely stunning book. If you haven't got time, it's an audiobook on Audible. You can listen to it while you drive.
Man,
it's
I'll listen to it.
Stunning. Yeah. But he describes Crisis as this shadow world, and just seeing these people made of these prisoners made of smoke being the people in his environment. And it was kind of like that. I was looking at people and trying to take orders for what they wanted to drink. I just wasn't seeing faces, and I was barely hearing words. And I ran up in the staff room, into the staff toilet, and just absolutely broke down crying. A bit of context: at this point, I just moved into, well, I'd been living for about a year in a in an apartment I couldn't afford. I hadn't talked to any members of my family for about 5 months. I was in a relationship that just really wasn't good for me. So this all kind of came to a head in this one moment. I'm sitting on a bathroom floor at work crying, trying to blubber vowel sounds over to my mum on the phone to communicate that I needed her to come and get me. And that night I went straight to hospital, got psychologically evaluated as suffering from severe clinical depression, and kind of existed in a mire for 3-4 months, until one night I was standing on the wrong side of the railings on the Tyne Bridge.
Oh.
Yeah, if I had taken one step forwards, I would have gotten very wet very quickly.
A bit more than just wet. Man.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was one of those moments where you just reflect on your entire experience, and I noticed the last time I could remember being happy was the last street show that I'd done 2 years earlier. And I thought about all the things that I hadn't yet achieved, and sword swallowing had been a recurring theme for something that I'd always wanted to learn. So I just decided that I had to give that at least my best shot. Climbed back over the hand railing. This was about 1 o'clock in the morning. Walked 2 hours home, and fell into bed. And if you're ever in any sort of crisis and need a little bit of self-guidance, what I did when I woke up, and I've been continuing doing this, I wrote myself a letter. Just explaining how I was feeling, the things that I was worried about, the things that I wanted to achieve. And then I just left it. And I've been writing myself a letter a month for, the last 5 years, really.
Wow.
And it doesn't even have to be to yourself. One of them is written to Chris Hemsworth when that Ghostbusters remake came out. And he was playing the himbo and the movie had failed. I just decided to write Chris Hemsworth a letter saying that it wasn't his fault. I never sent it, obviously. It was just a letter trying to express how I felt about my own achievements at that time. And it was easier to write it to Chris Hemsworth than it was to write it to me.
I get it.
If that makes sense. So, yeah. I've got a stack of letters. A few of them I've reread. Most of them I haven't. It's like that, and sword swallowing and getting back into street performing really helped me get back to a much healthier place. I'm still not 100% well, and I don't know how long it'll take me to be 100% well, if I ever even will be. But I'm in a much better place than I was. Certainly the happiest I've ever been since I was probably 9 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean, the sad fact is that a lot of performers do get very, very depressed.
Yeah, especially over the last 2 years with what we've all gone through.
I've seen it. And I've seen a lot of performers who have been getting very, very down now because they've spent 2 years spending time with their family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly the opposite. A lot of performers got really down over lockdown because they couldn't go and perform. Some performers, they enjoyed the time with their family and not going out every weekend and every evening and not seeing, missing important occasions. And now that the world is opening back up again, and they're running around the country, they're feeling like they're missing out, and they're having almost a crisis of, you know, what am I meant to do? You know, is performing for me? And, you know, we all know, you know, as a performer, you can be like traveling around late at night with no, you know, it's a very lonely existence.
Yeah.
And you're the guy that's got to go on stage and make people laugh.
Yeah, damn right. Yeah. I can't offer any advice to anybody in that position because I'm not in that position. But yeah, if anybody's looking for any advice on mental health, please do not get it from a green bearded twat on the internet. Go and see a professional. Mm-hmm. I promise you they can help you a lot faster than I can. Your wallet will be a little bit lighter, but it is worth the charge.
Fantastic. Good advice.
Yeah.
So you went from being very, very depressed to slowly starting to get better. And one of the things that helped you with that was buying a sword and shoving it down your throat.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
To say the least, yeah, it's kind of a bit bizarre, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, most people die by them. I survived by it. Weird. Yeah, it, like I said, it was something that I'd wanted to do for years, and I talked to different people, like sent the odd email out to people like Todd Robbins or Red in the States, asking for advice, and their advice had always been find a local sword swallower. Well, if you're living in the UK and looking for local sword swallowers, it becomes very apparent that there aren't many of them. And those that there are working quite a lot because there's not many of them. So they don't really have the time to offer that much guidance. So I kind of had to teach myself, which is not the way to go about something like sword swallowing. Like, if you're interested in learning sword swallowing, I heavily recommend getting in touch with me because I'm a street performer. I have nothing to do in the week. And I'm willing to help anybody train through that for a fee. Obviously, my time isn't I do have to still go out and earn money. But yeah, I taught myself and learned a lot of the hard lessons that you shouldn't really have to learn.
I was about to say, probably not the biggest, hardest lesson. I mean, that one, you know.
No, yeah, not that last one, not yet.
My gosh, crazy. I mean, that's crazy that. Yeah, it's crazy to me that you learned how to sword swallow and you're self-taught. I mean, I can just imagine, okay, right, I want to be a sword swallower. Okay, so I'm going to find somebody who can swallow swords.
Yeah.
Can't find anybody. Okay, so what am I going to do? Maybe I should just learn a new card trick. No, I'm going to give them a right. Okay, step A, grab the sword. Step B, lean back. Step C, go for it.
I did get a little bit of help on day 31. So I learned to sword swallow in 31 days. From start of actual physical practice to end of like successfully dropping a sword. Before that, I had done about 5 years of research by myself. But on day 31, I was performing my sideshow stuff at a tattoo convention in, I want to say near Birmingham, but not in Birmingham. And Bloody Bones, who performed at this Blackpool. Was there doing a spot as well. And so I went up and asked him for a bit of advice. And he guided me he gave me the information that I was missing. And with his help, I was able to get my first successful drop. And on that day, because it was the second day of the festival and we'd performed that night, I had some free time and a bit of extra cash in my pocket. I went and got my sword tattoo.
Wow, look at that. Throat.
So this is from day 31 of learning sword swallow.
Wow, That's awesome. And you still do that today, right?
Yes. It's taken a bit of a backseat to my magic show because I'm having more fun doing my street magic show, and I'm developing an indoor mentalism show, and I'm creating. And I'll be honest, sword swallowing just feels gross. And my health is, like, my physical health is pretty bad anyway, mainly because of birth problems. So I'm trying to look after myself as much as possible. And I realized, while I was performing in New Zealand for 5 months before the pandemic hit, I realized while I was out there that I couldn't just keep ramming a sword down my throat 3 times a day, every day, or it would impact quite severely. My voice was not always this low or this gravelly. This is something that's developed from smoking and sword swallowing.
Well, how old are you at the moment?
Guess.
I'd say about 27.
I'm 26, but you're closest.
Okay.
Yeah. When I was 19, somebody said 46.
Wow.
That didn't feel great. That did not feel great.
So 27, you're a young guy. You started sword swallowing at about the age of 21.
Yeah.
While you were sword swallowing, were you still keeping up with, and you weren't just doing sword swallowing, you were doing blockhead and all of this crazy mental stuff that's impressive, but very, very dangerous. Were you still practicing and learning and doing magic, or was that still taking aside?
No, that's always been a pretty solid thread. When was the first Minds convention? When I was 19, I released my first two PDFs on effects that I'd created. And I did that to pay for my ticket for Minds convention, which, if anybody doesn't know, it's a mentalism convention based in Newcastle run by Michael Murray. I was still creating and performing magic and mentalism all through that. But I tend to talk more about the sideshow stuff because it's more often the things that people want to hear. And yeah. I've earned the majority of my living from street performing.
Yeah. So that makes total sense. Let's talk about creating. You said you created your first effects at the age of 19.
I created my first effects at the age of 16. I released a couple of pieces at 19, yeah.
Okay. So what made you want to start releasing stuff to the general public? Not to the general public, sorry, to the general public of magicians, yeah. Was it a desire to become famous within the magic community? Or
fuck
was it just,
no.
I didn't think so.
Nobody in the magic community knows who I am, and that is fine.
Well, it's about to change with this interview, I'm telling you.
Oh no, conventions are going to get slightly easier, goddamn. Or slightly harder, depends on how you look at things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I've never been chasing any sort of fame. Admittedly, being able to go somewhere and just have a conversation with somebody without having to introduce yourself, that appeals to me, not going to lie. But no... To put it bluntly, if I wanted to be famous, I would not be a street performer. I would not be a mentalist. I would not be a magician. If I wanted to be famous, I would be a serial killer.
Yeah, but that would do the job.
Yeah, a bad serial killer. Those guys get famous real fast.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, no, there are way easier ways to get famous and there are infinitely easier ways to get rich. No, like, fame and money have never motivated me. I released my first two effects and I was too young to release them. And it was, to be honest, it was so I could pay to go to the Minds convention. And so if anybody bought those two PDFs, I apologize. Sincerely, because the material in there wasn't that great. The first one was called Mixed Signals. It was a Rubik's Cube routine with a miniature Rubik's Cube mixed up by a spectator, passed to another spectator to inspect. They select one of the faces, and with a little bit of fishing, I can tell them all the colors on that face.
See, that sounds great.
In order. It's nice. I'll be honest, the method... The method wasn't perfect. I've been reapproaching the idea over the last 3 years, and I've found just like easier ways to get there, more interesting ways to reveal So yeah, the method is what a 19-year-old would create, and the other one was ICLU, or impromptu coin location utility, because I like to have nice short titles. I'm actually reviving for my newest lecture as a liar truth teller routine.
Okay.
Because I am still proud of that effect and that method. I'm just not proud of the way that I formatted it when I was 19.
So, I get it.
Yeah, that's coming back out in my new lecture notes.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
No, I'm just finding this whole thing fascinating. So from there, you released these two PDFs at the age of 19.
Mm.
When was your next release?
Have
you been releasing stuff consistently through
the
last few years? Because obviously, I said at the beginning of this whole interview, you made a big name for yourself at Blackpool with two huge releases. And it felt like you came out of nowhere. And I'm really sorry, but I wasn't aware of your
before
Blackpool.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fine. I think my first release after that was 24, and it was my first release with MindFX, because by then I had actually become friends with Michael and had really started homing my style as a creator. That was, and it's still available for purchase at mindfx.co.uk. It is Mind Over Matter, and that was all of my playing card mentalism with shuffled deck in use, borrowed shuffled deck in. I don't like borrowing decks, feels weird to me, but shuffled deck in use. So that was all of that material in there. And then after that, I did a small run just for my lectures that I was doing at the time of my maths effects. My solution magic square, and the only magic square that can be taught in under 5 minutes and memorized. Anyway, that book was called How to Improve Your Math Skills by Eating Gifted Children.
Of course it was.
Yeah, I've been planning a run of three small booklets that I've kind of shelved, and they were all going to have ridiculous names. The next one should be effects that can play for close-up, parlor and stage, and it was going to be called I Come in All Sizes.
I love that.
Which I wish was my gag. It's a George Carlin line.
That's
from
great.
The Modern Man monologue.
That's great.
And then after that, what was after that? Blood, Sweat and Tears. Blood, Sweat and Tears is my smash and stab, but smash and stab done as prediction, because I've always hated the fact that smash and stab doesn't realistically have a perceived power associated to it. So I turned it into a prediction of human events. So I would take somebody through an imagination game where they choose whether I'm going to drink an imaginary glass of human tears or an imaginary glass of human sweat. And then based on their answer, I decide whether or not I can trust them. I have them select a bag non-verbally, and then I cleanly crush the bag that they've selected, which I have said already that's what I'll do. It's completely empty. I pull the nail out of nail through a card box or a block of wood out of the bag, and on the nail is a piece of paper that is removed by the audience member, opened up, and I've predicted their decision for the imagination game.
Wow.
Earlier. Yeah.
All of this is available through
Blood, Sweat and Tears is not currently, because that's a convention exclusive, basically because everything in that is real. There are safety techniques that I use within performance of that make it 100% safe. But I want to be selling that face to face, so I know that this person is so I can impress upon this person that they are going to actually follow those safety measures.
Got it.
Yeah, so that's a convention special. After that, during the convention, not during the convention, during the pandemic, I released Artistic License, which is a Magicians in Trouble tool. If a trick goes wrong, you can just say, if you view this as a theatre piece, you don't know what was going to happen. If we apply a little bit of artistic license, this is a successful theatre piece. No, really, look, artistic license. I pull out of my wallet a thing that looks like a driver's license and it says artistic license. So using that turn of phrase as a physical gag, and it's got a few things in there. It's got a card reveal for two of clubs down the first line of the text. It's got a card at number prediction in the membership number. It has a word test in the text on the back of the page and a magic square forcing up to 15 in the phone number. And that I kind of created because as a street performer, I get challenged by police or local enforcement, like councils a lot. And I found that most of the time, the people in trying to enforce the rules don't actually know the rules anyway. Mm-hmm. So if you just wave a thing that looks kind of official at them, they just go with that. It's like the magic wand. If you wave something that's supposed to have power, they just accept that it has power.
Yeah.
So I created that for street performers primarily, and then we released that to on Mind Effects. And then after that, yeah, it's straight into the Black Bull releases.
Wow. Well, wow. I mean, wow. I wasn't even aware of all of this. Right, okay. So let's quickly talk about the Black Bull releases, because these are your newest things, and a lot of people are talking about this. The first thing was the pocket-friendly cups and balls. Mm-hmm. With your history of working with Michael.
Yes.
What made you decide to go with Magic Box?
Purely because, and I had shown it to Michael, but I told him ahead of time that it was probably a Magic Box release, because it's more lighthearted, it's physical magic, it's a packet trick. We both didn't feel that it was the right fit for Mind Effects, for the Mind Effects brand. Michael has developed a very core audience of mentalism, and that's his wheelhouse, and he works amazingly within that wheelhouse. And obviously I, living in Newcastle, live very close to Magic Box. Before I moved out of my family home, I was literally 15 minutes walk away from where they are now.
Wow.
In Camberdown. Yeah, so it was always nice and convenient to get there. So I've got a good relationship with Magic Box now. There was that one time that they arrested me officially by the police, but I will not mention that too much. Right, fuck it. So around about 14, I was getting a bit too big for me boots, and I was just trying to do things, just anything. And I think I might have been a little bit, my parents were having a bit of struggle with work at the time, so I think I might have been feeling a little bit not neglected, but a little lack of attention that realistically I should have looked for other outlets for. But I tried to shoplift from Magic Box, and it was Chris Rubens and somebody else in the store at the time, and they caught me instantly because I was a fucking idiot, and called the police. I got arrested. I didn't get charged officially. I just had to write a letter of apology, and then I was banned. Banned for life from Magic Box. And then a couple of years later, when I was in college, I wanted to pick up a copy of Expert at the Card Table, Erdnes. So I wrote a little sign on a piece of A4 piece of paper saying, I won't come in, but I would like to buy this book. And it was Graham that answered the door to me. It was just like, just come in. And so started building a stronger relationship with Magic Box from then. And since then, I've worked on their stand at Blackpool. My first Blackpool, I was on the stand for Magic Box. And I was the first lecturer in the Magic Box Theatre.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, when I was 24, I think. Yeah, first lecturer in their new space. So yeah, I've got a good relationship. That was a very long way to get there. I've got a good relationship with Graham and Clive and Chris and Tom at Magic Box. So I thought the most natural place to take it would be there. I had considered Alakazam, but Peter, even though I've contributed stuff to a couple of things, like I was on the bonus material for Executive Suite. And I've contributed a few other ideas here and there. Peter doesn't really know me that well. And I wasn't sure taking something like him with taking something like this to him with what I will laughingly call my reputation was the right move, because nobody knows who I am. So the most natural place to take it was Magic Box and Graham and Clive.
Plus, you can't get further away from Kent than Newcastle, really, in the UK.
Yeah, no, not really.
you're gonna go down Alakazam. It's gonna be like an 8.5 hour, 9 hour drive one way.
Absolutely. I didn't want to submit something because I don't drive yet. This is my year to change that. I don't drive yet, so I would have to take the train or just not go. And I don't want to release a project in that I'm not the person explaining it.
Mm.
Because not that other people don't do amazing jobs at teaching, because there are some absolutely fabulous teachers out there. It's just, as it's my material, I feel like I know the more important points to focus on. Most of the time I get a bit rambly in front of a camera just because no physical people here to stop me. But yeah, I wouldn't be comfortable putting something out in which I'm not the face of that. Also, I would prefer, like, if I put out a bad trick, I want that hatred to come to me because I'm the source of that problem. If I put out a bad trick and say Peter is the face of that effect through the explanations and everything like that, I don't want any of that negativity reflecting back onto their brand.
Yeah.
If I fucked something up, that is my fault.
Yeah, I got it. That makes sense. But then at the same time, I mean, the two tricks that you had out at Blackpool are about as polar opposite as you can get. You've got this really fun, quirky packet trick, in essence, you know, that's very magical. And then you've got this solid collection of mentalism routines. And I am, of course, talking about Fast, which Fast sold out at Blackpool, which is...
Yeah. Yeah, first time that's ever happened to me. And I'll be honest, we didn't expect that at all. Kind of because we didn't advertise it at all. There was one line before Blackpool in a Magic Cafe post from Michael in the new releases for Blackpool thing that says, and Daniel Dorian Johnson is bringing out the Fast project. That is literally the only advertising we had done for that. And then I spent the first day deming Bergfast, which was the first effect on the collection, to anybody who would slow down for long enough for me to say, "Oh, you." So I demmed that to just about everybody on that day. And then the second day, what I was not expecting to happen was people coming back and saying, "We've been told to come and see this," by people in the Ruskin, people in the lobby, or people online. And then, people were coming up all through Saturday to see it because they'd heard about it. And then on Sunday, we started that day with, I believe, 20 left. We arrived at the dealer's hall at 10:30, because if you know anything about the Mind Effects group, it is that most of us are heavy drinkers and we are all late nighters. So Michael wasn't even on the stand. Michael was drunk, passed out in bed. I arrived at 10:30 at the dealer's stand. We got everything opened up, and by 11:10 we had sold out.
Wow, that's incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
And so people that want to get the Fast project that weren't at Blackpool, it's available on the Mind Effects site, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. And basically it's a collection of mentalism style card routines.
Mentalism and gambling routines, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Using a deck of cards and a principle.
Yeah, a core system.
The basis behind the principle people might be aware of, but you've expanded it in a completely different direction.
Yeah, I've literally flipped it the other way around and modified it slightly, and in doing that found so much you can kind of squeeze out of the bastard. And in combining it with some of my own techniques, like the 4x4, the 4x4s, which is something that I've been trying to find an effect for years, but just never had the right fit, nothing that fit it properly.
Mm-hmm.
So did you just try and hide a yawn there?
No.
All right, okay, you just pulled a little face. I totally understand. You've had a really busy, you've had a really busy month, dude.
No, not at all.
Sorry. Yeah, so the 4x4 found its way into being Bergfast. The first routine, which for anybody that doesn't know, it's an any card at any number. In which you're the one person I didn't want to talk about this in front of. Because arguably you've released the most visually powerful card at any number I've ever seen.
the Quantum. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Quantum. Props to you. Absolute props to you. Because, yeah, like, I don't think... I know there's been, like, a lot of backlash and shit like that. I don't care about weighing in on that because visually, that is the most impressive any card at any number there is. You cannot beat the visual of that effect. Absolutely, hands down. But we're talking about me, so... fast. Yeah. When developing something like that, a lot of the things... the main thing that everybody gets wrong about the Berglass effect is it's described by Berglass as being you never appear to touch the deck. So that's... what hopefully I've achieved with fast. Occasionally there's a little bit of reframing to be done, but it's really not stressful. It's not like heavy misdirection based stuff, nothing like that. And so, yeah, I've created by smashing together two or three things that have existed for over 100 years. The closest practical thing you can do to the Berglass effect with a regular deck.
And you know what? I said at the very beginning, and I'll be reviewing this project soon on Magic TV, and I know it'll get a great review. And
if you hate it, tell me you hate it.
Oh, don't worry, I will.
Yeah.
You can take that from the bank. But I know I'm gonna like it. But one of the things that I really respect about you, and I said at the beginning that I respect you as a person as well, is because without giving any methods away, I've explored part of the method.
Yes.
In a project that I've brought out at some point without giving anything away. At some point, I released a project and you, I never heard of you before, and you just phoned me out the blue.
Yeah, the first time you heard my voice was me saying, I'm really sorry, but I've got this thing.
Yeah, and you were like, look, I know you've got this. This is mine. This is what it does. Do I have your blessing to bring it out? And I'm like, I mean, it's got the same core principle, but you've gone in one direction, I've gone in the other direction, mm-hmm. polar opposites. But the fact that you picked up the phone and you made that phone call, I was blown away. I really was. And that shows your character and it shows the type of person that you are. Seriously.
I believe it would be wrong to do anything else, to be honest. And at that point, you sent me the project that your work was on. Yeah. But at that point, I hadn't actually seen it. So I didn't know if we were using the same method or not. And I didn't want to, like, obviously as a creator, I'm never going to make a dent in like you. Nothing that I'm creating or releasing is ever going to be taking out of your pocket. You are infinitely bigger of a voice and a presence than I am. And I accept that and I'm happy about that. But to not do something like that would just be wrong.
Yeah, and you're a stand-up guy, and everything that you've ever brought out that I've seen has been incredible, incredible. And, you know, we talked about Ryland off camera. His new favourite trick is the pocket-friendly cups and balls. Like, and he sees a lot of magic, so that should tell you everything that you need to know.
No, I don't. I've got three units, and I didn't bring any of them up here, so never mind.
Well, you know, let me ask you a question. Obviously, you've said several times in this interview that you've made your living, or you make your living from street performing, but
you're becoming, especially with the impact that you made on Blackpool, you're becoming more well-known now as a creator. Mm. You've talked about how you're putting a new lecture together. You've talked about how, you know, you've been given opportunities to lecture all over the place. And I know, you know, and we can talk about this. I know that you've got other ideas and new, you're not resting on your laurels. There's other stuff you're bringing to market.
No, yeah.
Are you planning on focusing more as a creator kind of like embracing that world more? Is it still street performing that's going to be your main focus?
So street performing is my primary focus because it is my oldest and most supportive love, to be honest. It was there for me when I was in the worst place I could possibly be, and it supported me all the way through the worst times that the world has possibly seen as of late. So street performing will always be my main focus. That said, realistically, outside of the summer months, I work 2 days a week. So I have a lot of extra time to sit and think and write and create. So I'm going to keep creating. My plan is to not release more than 2 things a year.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to hit burnout. Number one, and I want to make sure what I'm releasing is actually good material, because at this point, for all the magic community's given me, it deserves that level of respect back. I don't expect to be doing more than 2 releases a year, probably down to 1, to be honest. Just Blackpool be the new thing, and then it's up until next Blackpool. I'm wanting to put a bit more focus into lecturing. I'm happy to come and lecture wherever anybody wants me. I would love to do that. Like you've mentioned, I've got a new lecture which is called Desperate Act, and it's
for a lecture.
Weirdly enough, I think of really good names, and then a lot of the time it's thinking of the name and then finding material to fit that. But that has fucked me up a few times. I've been trying to think of an effect for a name I've had for 2 years now. The name is Village Idiom. I've been trying to think of an effect for 2 years based on that goddamn name. Desperate Act is all about that sort of lost show scenario. What happens if you arrive to a gig somewhere and they've lost your luggage and you've just got to dive to the local like corner shop and build an act? So Desperate Act is all of my material that I have had to do that with in the past, because I've lost a lot of shit. I've lost expensive electronics on the way to gigs. It's never fun. But having that happen forces you to be a lot more creative.
That sounds like a really good lecture. One of my favorite projects in mentalism is an old DVD that LNL...
Is it called Nothing?
With Max Maven, yeah.
Mind Reader, wow. Yeah, yeah. I've never seen it. I've been trying to hunt it down for ages and I just can't find a goddamn copy anywhere. But yeah, I've never seen it, unfortunately. But I love the premise. And... weirdly enough, I think this might have been before Max released that. This drive to always have something ready in the back pocket comes from the first magic convention I ever kind of attended. I was only at the evening show. It was South Tyneside Magic Convention. I went with my family, and that was the year that David Williamson was there, and he had lost all his luggage.
Mm.
And I remember being in the bar just before the doors opened, looking over and seeing you and David Penn sitting at a table. You had a Sharpie on top of an overturned glass or on top of a glass bottle, and you were making it spin. I seem to remember.
Sounds about right. Sounds like the sort of thing that David Penn would have done. Yeah.
No, it was you controlling the spin.
Oh, it was me doing the spin. Wow, that sounds less likely, but oh my gosh, wow.
It might have been David. I've no
that idea. That might have been in my mind reading phase. I didn't even realize I had a mind reading phase, but the power of my mind.
Who hasn't? Who hasn't?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. South Tyneside is a great convention. It's a fantastic convention. Wow, that's great. So But I've got two more questions for you.
And yeah, have I answered any of the questions you've actually asked so far?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have. This has been an incredible interview. Like, absolutely incredible. I've found it so fascinating finding out about you, to be perfectly honest.
Thank you.
As somebody who's created so much magic, do you have any advice on creativity and specifically maybe about the inspiration behind it? Because...
Yes.
That's something that people really struggle with. You know, they sit there looking at a deck of cards, desperately wanting to create something, whether that be for their own act, to make their own act more unique, whether it be to eventually maybe sell to people. And it's that creativity side of things that really most people, when they come into this industry, they struggle with.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that because, again, I'm writing a lecture about this. Wow. Called The Seventh Day. It's a much more theatrical style lecture. Think if Derek Delgadio was really pretentious and just wanted to talk about creating magic tricks, which I don't know why anybody would want to see, but if you do book that lecture. The Seventh Day is all about creating. And the way I create most of the time is in a vacuum. Not shutting myself off to other influences, it is deliberately limiting what I'm allowed to do. So, fuck it. Let's go through one now. Name a plot in magic.
The Vanishing Bandana.
The Vanishing Bandana. Okay. Is it the actual trick that we're looking at? No, we'll just run with the Vanishing Bandana as a premise. That's fine. What are we not allowed to use?
A banana or a bandana.
We're not allowed to use a banana or a bandana. One more limitation.
One more limitation. I don't know. It has to be able to be performed on stage and close up.
On stage and close up. Good. And then we get into the things that we are allowed, not are allowed, that we have to use. What do we have to include? This can just be one or two things.
Okay. We have to use a key and we have to use a tie.
Okay, great. Well, you've pre-selected the props that we're going to be using now. That's excellent. What I would do with the prompt like that is work within those restrictions. So the way that I created Bergfast, and I don't want to give away too much now because pay me money. I was sitting around with my good friend Ian Ragg or Raggy, and I was going through this whole thing, and the prompts were, any card at any number, it has to be any card, you can't appear to touch the deck, and you have to be able to do it with any deck. Those were the prompts. Now, at that moment, I was able to construct what is the bare bones of Bergfast now, but you could only do it with the clubs. You couldn't, or one suit. You could only use one suit. You couldn't do the whole thing, which we obviously weren't happy with. And then a couple months later, sitting down, I had an hour to spare. I just looked at constructing a way to do that, to make sure that would happen, finally figured it through, and then realized that it was based on older systems already pre-existing in magic. So that was how Bergfast was created. And then knowing that so much already exists with that system, I started looking at what we could do with my new variation on that system, which is where the rest of the material for Fast was born from.
Wow.
So I deliberately create within a vacuum, or I take an effect that I like an idea of or a visual of or just the premise of, and I try and fix the problems. So I don't want to talk out of school, but Pocket Friendly Cups and Balls came kind of out of my love for cups and balls, my genuine love of cups and balls. But also remembering a review you did of Poor Man's Cups and Balls and not being too pleased with just the effect. There seemed to be some illogical actions in there. There was way too many cards for my taste. There was awkward moves and difficult little things that had to be done, and the cards couldn't be examined at the end. So pocket friendly cuffs and balls kind of came out of wanting to solve those problems, as well as too many phases. I think most magic tricks die on too many phases.
Yeah.
So with pocket friendly cuffs and balls, it's what are the fundamental effects in cuffs and balls? There are balls, there are no balls, there are big balls.
Yeah.
Realistically, that's what people are going to talk about. They're not going to talk about you forcing it through the bottom of the cup, and they're not going to talk about how you managed to tap it from one cup to another. They're going to talk about there were balls, and then he made them vanish, and then there were big balls.
Yes.
That's how people tend to describe the cups and balls, audience members at least. I know magicians tend to get into the minutiae of things. So it was about finding a way to do that with genuinely only four cards in use. And no gaffed cards, ostensibly. There's no double faces, there's no double backers, there's no halves, there's no flaps, there's nothing like that. And a big focus on make it simple for yourself. Make it as easy as humanly possible so you're not focused on method as much, and you can actually focus on being a performer. Because at the end of the day, a magician is not really hired to do magic tricks. A magician is hired to make people feel something, whether that's joy, whether that's laughter, whether that's terror, whether that's genuine emotional like upheaval. A magician is hired to take an audience on some emotional journey experience. Yeah. So the less that we can worry about, oh shit, I've now got to do a Scarnio spread, and then I've got to do an Elmsley count, and then I've got to go and do into this one thing from John Bannon's thing, and so on. The less that we can focus on doing that, the more that we can focus on actually being with an audience.
Yeah, that's really good. Wow, you're a fountain of knowledge, aren't you? People that are watching this need to book you immediately for a
lecture. I have nothing to do in the week, so I just sit and think about things. And my partner doesn't understand what I do for a living. She thinks that I get paid to put balls under cups while nobody's looking. And to a certain extent, she is right. But like most of, most of the way I exist is by thinking about every little minute aspect of what we do and figuring out how I can use that to our advantage. It's weaponized autism. Essentially, all I've done is taken a pre-existing neurotypical thing that exists within me and figured out how to use it to its best effect.
Wow. That's amazing. So one last question. What's next for you? What's coming up? Like, you're only 26.
Mm.
You've achieved a hell of a lot. You've been through a hell of a lot. You know, we've discussed this during the interview. You've had highs, you've had lows. You've said yourself, you're in the best place that you've ever been in. You're really kind of coming into your own as a creator. You're an established street performer that's just absolutely bossing it in that side of things. We're hopefully through the worst of COVID, and hopefully that's going to lead to a renaissance when it comes to entertainment. So, you know, what is left for you to achieve on your magical bucket list? Are you wanting, you know, what are you wanting to achieve both as a performer and as a creator?
So I will be lecturing next year at Magic Live in Vegas. That's a lie. I have not been booked to be at Magic Live, but that would be amazing. No, I am wanting to actually sit down and, well, I've started the work on it, write an indoor show, an actual theatre show. And I've got the work on it already. I've got the effects, I've got the core premise. It just hasn't been run in front of an audience, and we still need to get props built. But yeah, I want to take my theatre show to the Fringe and hopefully start touring with that. And interestingly enough, it comes back to something that we were talking about right at the start of the lecture. It's called This Is You. And remember when I was talking about the envelopes, writing myself little letters? It's heavily to do with a lot of that. Again, I don't want to mention him again, but imagine if Derek Delgadio had a green beard and no budget. and only 45 minutes in which to bring you on an emotional journey as opposed to an hour and a half. It's kind of in that sort of vein. If Luke Jermaine was slightly taller and didn't have as many tattoos. That's kind of more what I'm looking at working towards within that oeuvre.
Wow. Genre. And are you going to be at this year's Fringe?
Yes. I don't know if I'll have the indoor show up and running for that, but I, outside of COVID, haven't missed a Fringe for the last 7 years, I think. Six years. A while. Edinburgh is essentially my second home. I have a tattoo for the streets of Edinburgh on my arm. So even if I'm on, I will be on the streets, even if I'm doing an indoor show. But yeah, if you come up to the Royal Mile and you're at the Fringe, you will find a green bearded twat trying to fix a table in the corner behind the church. And that will be me. Yeah.
Amazing. And as a creator, you said that you're hoping to release one thing out a year. Is that going to be the goal? Like, do you have an ultimate goal as a creator? You know, you mentioned Magic Live. Is there anything else you'd like to do?
I want to continue to create material that I feel is worth being released. And I really want to create material that is kind of flipping certain older ideas on their head, but still really workable. I don't have one up here, but sneak preview, which will possibly be out next year or the next Blackpool or the Blackpool after. I'm working on a book test.
Okay.
And the premise of the book test, and I'm putting this down on film so nobody can steal it off me before then, is you name a word, you name a number. I flick to the that numbered page in the book. The only word printed on that page is the word that you've named. Not only is it the only word printed on that page, it's the only word printed in the book.
What?
Yeah, it is the complete antithesis to a book test. And I 100%, I owe the visual of that to Quantum.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
That's- yeah.
Wow. What? I can't even imagine. That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I've got a working method for it. It's just about constructing the book in the correct fashion.
You do realize selling your soul to the devil is not a working method. You can't sell that, right? Wow.
You could probably sell contracts. I don't know.
Yeah, I reckon you could. That's really good, man. I want to see that. Wow. I want to see that. That's amazing. Wow. Okay. Well, there you go. There, we already know what trick of the year, Blackpool 2023 or 2024, whenever it is.
No,
there, you know.
No. If
you're a creator and that's coming out, man. No, they're done.
Me out of the water.
They're done. They're done. Anyone else is done. Yeah. See you later. Wow. Fantastic. Well, you know what? I have become and will continue to be a huge fan of yours, Mr. Freak. I think that you are absolutely one of the good guys in magic. I also think that your material is really strong. And more importantly, you're a really nice person as well, which is important in this industry. So it's great to have you on the channel. Your creations that people, do they go to the various different companies like Magic Box or do you have your own website that people can buy stuff from?
I don't have my own website because I don't want to worry about the business side of things. So most of my material is out through Mind Effects and the Pocket Friendly Cups and Balls is available through Magic Box. If you see me lecturing at anywhere, I will have copies of my lecture notes for Desperate Act. Probably a couple of units of Fast, but outside of that, I probably won't be carrying much stock on me because, like I said, I'm physically impaired, so carrying round shit tons of stock just ain't gonna happen.
Yeah,
but yeah.
But you can get them from Magic Box and also from
MindFX. MindFX.co.uk. Michael Murray. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, that's fantastic. So you want to go check out the material that we've talked about, and you do want to go check out the material we've talked about, trust me. Watch for the review coming soon. Then go to mindfx.co.uk or magicbox.uk.co.
Yes.
I know it's got a .uk and then it's...
If you Google, yeah, Magic Box Newcastle, and then look for the one, I think it's either the top or the second result. Just look for the one that doesn't say fancy dress.
Yeah, I'll put a link at the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be the best way. So, guys, yeah, thank you so much one more time for coming on the channel and spending time with us. I know that whatever you continue to do, you will be successful at it because, yeah, I can just tell that you wired that way. And if people want to reach out with you, you've talked about how you'll happily give advice on street performing or anything.
Yeah.
How can people contact you?
Yeah, if you message me through Instagram, which is MrFreak_StreetShow, or if you want to find me on Facebook, Facebook's a little bit less reliable because I'm trying not to add people that I don't already have mutual friends, because I've let a lot of magicians that I've never met or talked to slip in over the years. But if Facebook's easier for you, shoot me a friend request and immediately shoot me a message on Facebook. On Facebook, I'm Daniel Dorian Johnson. You'll be able to find me there.
Cool. So Daniel Dorian Johnson on Facebook and MrFreak_ street shows.
Street show, yeah.
Street show on Instagram. So make sure you connect with this man. If you're wanting to be a street performer, he's already said that he is available to mentor. And
always happy to help anybody that wants to learn, yeah.
That's amazing. And, you know, thank you one more time. I really appreciate you coming on the channel.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm a huge fan. I am a huge fan.
And he's only seen one of my tricks. That's cool.
I know. I can't wait to delve into the Fast Project. I know it's going to be amazing. I've got a fun few days ahead of me. So I'm purposefully not showing Ryland because I'm going to learn it all myself and then blow him out of the water.
Good, because there's also a little bit of swearing on there. Going to be adding...
Ryland's my son. There. You get that, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think there's a swear word that he hasn't heard at this point.
I was so worried when you did the review show and Ryland said he had watched the executive suite instructions without you. Like, oh, I made a real dirty joke on that one. Oh, no.
Oh, was it about the dungeon?
Yeah.
You know what's really funny? He watched it without me and he loves that trick. He does that trick all of the time. And he took that joke and made it his own, and he didn't really understand the joke. So every single time he does it now in his gigs, he goes, oh, this is the dungeon. He talks about how his dad goes and performs all over the world as a magician, and he brings room keys home, and he collects room keys. And then he brings out this one, and he's going, the dungeon. I don't know what my dad was doing there. It seems a bit weird to me. And that's his joke. And he doesn't even understand the joke or why it's funny.
That is exactly the sort of joke that a 9-year-old should be making. That's fair. Should not be making the gag that I made on there.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's not a laugh line. If Ryland does the joke that I made on there, that's not a reason to laugh. That's a reason to call the police, is the problem.
Yeah, so he adapted it for his own use. So that's a great trick. Executive Suite is an amazing trick.
Wonderful piece.
But yeah, so they're going to contact you. I want you to do me a favor, everybody. I want you to leave a comment in the comments down below. I'm sure Freak. I'm sure Freak will see them. So make sure you leave a comment in the comments down below. Show some love. That's very important. Go buy all this man's stuff. Go support him. Follow him on Instagram. Do all the fun stuff. If you find yourself in Newcastle, go and watch his street show. And yeah, one more time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel, Magic TV, which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.